Today at Reader's Corner, we talk to David Nywert, author of the book Of Orcas and Men, What Killer Whales Can Teach Us. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Until a few decades ago, the killer whales of the Puget Sound were frequently captured by the dozens and sold for entertainment at marine parks across the U.S. Today, these incredible creatures are the subject of new protections and increased scientific inquiry. But their waters remain under threat. Pollution and marine traffic continue to wreak havoc, and orcas' ability to thrive is still very much in doubt. In his book, Of Orcas and Men, What Killer Whales Can Teach Us, journalist and author David Nywert explores our fascination with one of the Earth's most intelligent animals and the potentially catastrophic consequences of that appeal. David Nywert is an investigative journalist based in Seattle and a contributing writer for the Southern Poverty Law Center. His work has appeared in the Washington Post, Salon, MSNBC, and elsewhere. His other books include And Hell Followed With Her and Alt-America, The Rise of the Radical Right in the Age of Trump. David Nywert, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you for having me, Bob.
Well, let's start off with the basics, David. Introduce us to the orca killer whale. How long have they been around? How long have they been in the Salish Sea, better known as Puget Sound? And how do scientists classify the distinct orca populations we find in the Northwest?
Now, that's a handful. But put simply, killer whales have been around for 6 to 8 million years, which is a lot longer than human beings have been around. And probably for the last 3 or 4 million of those years, they've been the predominant apex predator of the oceans. Pretty much since the megalodon went extinct, the killer whales have been the rulers of the seas. And simultaneously, they have the second largest brain of any animal on the planet, second only to sperm whales, and their brain is probably the most complex brain of any animal on the planet. The cortical folding in their brains, which is called gyrification, is phenomenal. Humans have a pretty high gyrification index of about 2.3. Killer whales' gyrification index is 5.7. Wow. So we are only beginning to glimpse how intelligent these animals are. They certainly have the largest CPU of any animal on the planet, if you were to put brain power into as in computer language. But in the Northwest, well, they've occupied these waters up here in the Salish Sea ever since the glaciers receded several hundred thousand years ago, at the end of the Ice Age. And as far as we can tell, the particular subspecies that we see here a lot, or they call it an ecotype, they call them resident killer whales. And these are strictly salmon and fish-eating killer whales. And they're about 80 to 90% of their diet is Chinook salmon. They're very picky eaters. But as it happens, there are a lot of ecotypes of killer whales all around the world. They are in every ocean on the planet. In Antarctica, you will find 5 different ecotypes of them. In the Atlantic, you'll find at least 2 or 3 different ecotypes that we know of. And here in the Pacific, just in the northern Pacific, we know of 3 ecotypes, including, of course, the residents. But then there are also what we call transient killer whales, or Biggs killer whales. And those killer whales, their diet is primarily seals and sea lions, as well as young whales of other species, typically humpbacks or gray whales. And those whales, they look identical to the residents, unless, you know, if you have a trained eye, you can see subtle differences in them. But otherwise, they're really quite similar. But when they did gene testing on these animals, they discovered that the residents and the transients have not had any genetic interaction for over 300,000 years, which is longer than human beings have been around. So it's pretty fascinating stuff, you know. There's big cultural difference. They never have anything to do with each other. They have no communications with each other. And in fact, typically the residents will chase transients out of whatever waters they're in, typically because residents travel in much larger groups. So that's kind of a quick picture of what they are. But the southern resident killer whales that are here in the Salish Sea, are on the endangered species list. In fact, we're down to now 75 whales in this population, which scientists say if they get down to below 60, they won't have a viable gene pool anymore and will probably be doomed to extinction. So we're very concerned about them and working very hard to try to restore them to health.
How long does an orca whale live, both in the wild, and then how long do they have they lived in captivity?
Well, in the wild, they have lives very similar to human lives. We know that the males typically will live up to about 60 years, and the females will live to as old as 100.
Like Granny?
Like Granny J2, who passed away a few years ago, but was believed to be about 100 years old when she did. And I think the current oldest southern resident female now is 85. And she is the mother of the last remaining captive orca from the Puget Sound, who is Lolita, the killer whale that's held at the Miami Seaquarium. And she's been there for 45 years.
Didn't she just lose a court battle? I think there was an attempt last year in the courts to free her, and I'm not so sure that worked out.
It did not work out. Yeah. The courts have generally supported the rights of these marine park owners to possess these whales, even if they are, as in Lolita's case, members of an endangered population. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so they... Between 1964 and 1974, or 76 actually, they removed about 60 orcas from this population, formed the basis for SeaWorld and all of the other marine parks that display killer whales. All of the original orca captures were from these waters. And the assumption was that there were thousands of these whales out there. And then scientists went to work in the early 70s and figured out, whoops, guess what? We only have now about 80 of these whales remaining after they had taken 60 of them out of the population. Mm-hmm. So that was when the state of Washington shut down the captures and said, you can't take any more whales. And so the marine parks just moved their operations to, they moved mostly to Iceland, is where they then started capturing whales. So a lot of the whales you see at SeaWorld now are actually descendants from Icelandic whales. And all of those 60 orcas that they captured, except for Lolita, died. Most of them within a few years of capture. I think the average lifespan for an orca in captivity is about 13 years. And at least that's been the case at SeaWorld. It's even shorter at some of these other parks, which SeaWorld is actually probably the best place, relatively speaking, for these animals because they have better facilities.
And one just died there, I believe.
Yeah, another one just died down in Orlando. And they just keep losing them because what people don't understand is that it's just a tremendous amount of stress for these animals. Orcas swim constantly. They even swim when they're sleeping. So they'll swim up to 100 miles a day in the wild. You put an animal like that in a relatively tiny concrete tank where they just have to swim in circles, it's extremely stressful for them. One of the reasons you see so many of them with flopped over fins is that's actually a function of the fact that in those captive situations, they have to spend so much time at the surface. In the wild, orcas spend 95% of their time underwater. And in captivity, they spend 95% of their time at the surface. Those fins are actually just collagen. They don't have any kind of rigid structure in them. So in the wild, they will naturally remain straight and true because the orcas spend most of their time underwater where gravity doesn't have any effect on those fins. But as soon as they start spending time on the surface, gravity starts hitting those fins and eventually they all flop over.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with David Nywert, author of the book Of Orcas and Men. In the book, Nywert explores our often fatal fascination with one of the world's most intelligent animals. Let me pick up on something you said regarding just how intelligent the orca is. And you also, in reference to Lolita's court case, said in one sense the humans won and the owners get to keep the animals, and Lolita will not be freed. But you also, in your book, talk about the Non-Human Rights Project, which is way beyond just whales, but really a project. There's any number of projects like this that are beginning to address the issue of whether or not animals have rights. I wonder if you could talk about that in terms of the orca and where you think this movement is going.
Well, I would say that obviously the orca is probably a prime candidate for being considered for non-human rights, for actually having rights, partly because they are so intelligent. And they're really phenomenal animals that we're only starting to understand the complexity and depth of their social arrangements and their interior lives. But what we do know is that putting them in captivity is just tremendous deprivation. It's not just that spatial deprivation, but it's also sensory deprivation, because you're putting this animal that uses echolocation for its primary sense into a plain concrete tank. It's like putting a human into a plain white room. And it's actually amazing, and I think a testament to their strength, their internal strength, that they, more of them, don't go insane and kill their trainers, frankly. And then there's, of course, the social deprivation that happens, because in the wild, they have incredible social lives because they spend their entire lives with their mothers, with their families. And the echolocation sense binds them in ways that we can't even really begin to understand, because they not only see each other in the water, they see inside each other. They can tell when another member is pregnant or sick, because essentially they get back, what the echolocation gives back to them is a sonogram. And so they have incredibly intimate social connections, and they're able to sense each other's moods and feelings through this echolocation. So it's really an amazing social life that they have. And when you throw them into these marine parks where they're just randomly put together with other animals, they lose all of that incredible social life that they have. And quite frequently in captivity, orcas do become very aggressive with each other, occasionally kill each other, because they don't have those social bonds that they would have in the wild. In the wild, the animals almost never attack each other. Mm-hmm. They're incredibly peaceful, which is, of course, part of what marine parks taught us. I mean, marine parks did show us that before the marine parks came along, everybody thought that orcas were like giant, really smart sharks who were voracious killers. And what we found out was that, no, they're actually really gentle, highly intelligent, very sweet animals, and very easily trained, too, because maybe they're smarter than us. You know, you never know. A lot of it depends on how you define intelligence.
So in the history of the Northwest coastal legends and Western mythology, at one point you say in your book that basically orcas have pretty much always scared the hell out of Western civilization. Tell us a little bit about the Northwestern Indian lore and how that fits into the plight of the orca.
Sure. Well, yeah, for Westerners, you know, I mean, the name Ursinus orca means demon from hell. Mm-hmm. So Westerners always were very afraid of these animals. But the Northwest Native tribes, of course, lived around them, and particularly the coastal tribes. And they honored the killer whales as beings with tremendous spiritual power. And so they put them into their carvings and carve them into their lodges and their totem poles and all these kind of things. And, of course, they're a big part of their legends. Some of the tribes actually believe that the first humans were killer whales who came to the land and transformed themselves. And that's their origin story. And so when they see a killer whale in the water, they believe that they're, you know, seeing their ancestors and their family members. The interesting thing is that all up and down the coast, all of these tribes, it was totally forbidden to do any harm to these animals because, well, for one thing, it was believed that they would kill you in retaliation, because they are very powerful animals. But also because I think that they just had the status as beings of great spiritual power and beings that the humans were connected with. They were, in a lot of ways, because they all ate the salmon. And so when the tribes would see the salmon runs coming in, they believed that the killer whales were bringing them in for them.
Didn't the tribes also play a role in protection? I believe it was the Lummi tribe that actually just tried to come up with a plan to rescue one of these captive whales. Was that Lolita or was that somebody else to return it to its waters? near the tribe lands.
Yes, it was the lead. They had a sort of cross-country tour of trying to raise awareness of the plight of Lolita and hope to bolster the campaign to return her to these waters, which apparently is, right now, there's actually a project going on with the folks who run the Non-Human Rights Project to create a killer whale sanctuary out here in these waters, where those animals could be basically retired, the ones that are in captivity. They can still receive human care and get all the care that they need, but they won't be stuck in a tiny little concrete tank. Mm-hmm. They'll have fresh water, they'll have complex environment with fish and rocks and everything else out there. You know, these animals, especially the ones that are born in captivity, could never be released to the wild, but they deserve better lives than what they have now.
What kind of an area would that be where they would be returned? And would they have any interaction with the other members of their former pod, let's say?
Well, I think that's kind of what they're hoping with Lolita, is that if they were able to get her into a sanctuary out here, they would hope that maybe she would reconnect with her family. And I think if that happened, they would have to reassess the, you know, continued captivity for her, especially if it became apparent that she was capable of staying up with them, as well as, you know, that the interest was reciprocated. All of those would be questions we'd have to look at as time went on. But yeah, you know, I think the key to Lolita's retirement, especially, and of course she's kind of emblematic of the whole sanctuary project, because she's more or less the model for them. Her teeth are in good shape, so she could still hunt. A lot of captive orcas have ground down their teeth, so they could never really be capable of hunting. But Lolita doesn't have that problem. The biggest problem is that she's been in captivity for 45 years. One thing we do know from the experiment with Keiko, the Free Willy killer whale, who they did release after 6-7 years of trying to rehabilitate him, was that it's not successful if you don't reunite them with their family. You know, that's really the key for all of these animals. They can't survive if they're not with their families. They don't do well on their own. They're very much community-oriented. So I think the whole point of Lolita is more than reuniting her with her family is a kind of dream, and probably a pie-in-the-sky dream. But more than anything, I think everybody just believes she belongs in something other than the tiniest orca tank in North America, which is what she is living in, been living in for the last 45 years. It's almost obscene how tiny her tank is, and it's amazing that she's done as well as she has, has managed to survive as well as she has.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is David Nywert. He's author of the book Of Orcas and Men. Let's talk for a moment about the southern resident, the ones who are free and are swimming across the Salish Sea. I'd like to take the challenges they have one by one. So the first one I'll mention is boats, traffic, and noise. If you could tell us what that does to interfere with the life and the daily activity of an orca.
Boats and traffic, for one thing, do affect where and how they will swim, so it'll interrupt their hunting if a boat crosses their path while they're trying to chase their prey. But more than anything, what it does is it creates a lot of noise underwater. And their echolocation, their ability to see underwater, is dependent on their echolocation, which is a sound-based sense. And you know, a lot of sound will basically block their ability to get any signal back from the signal they send out. So more or less blinds them if anything is really loud in the water. And one of the issues that, of course, has come up in the process of trying to restore the endangered population is the whale watching boats that go out to see them. And in fact, one of the proposals that's currently before Washington Governor Jay Inslee and his orca board that they assembled to try to address the decline of the population. One of their proposals is to, you know, put a moratorium on whale watch boats around the southern residents for 5 years, with the hope that they would free them up to hunt more readily. But I have to tell you, I'm very skeptical of that proposal, because I do listen to them out there in the water a lot with hydrophone. And it's very obvious that the whale watch boats are a pretty minor problem for them, because the noise is pretty short-lived and it's not terribly loud. The real noise problem they have out there is the big ships that ply these waters on their way to Vancouver. There are huge freighter ships that come through. And those ships put up just tremendous amounts of racket. I've been listening to killer whales in the water out there, and had one of these ships come sort of into aural view of the whales, and the noise got so loud that the whales just stopped talking. And indeed, they stopped moving, or at least, you know, they stayed more or less in place where they were hunting as I was doing this. And this went on for 15, 20 minutes. So that's the other problem with the ship noise, it's sustained. It's not like the whale watch boats, which is pretty short-lived. These ships passing through these waters, it'll make noise for up to 45 minutes that will really interfere with the whale's ability to hunt. So that's the first issue.
So does the state of Washington have any control over the big ships? I mean, what did they do? Choose the whale watching boats because they could, and meanwhile, they can't control the big ships? And has there been an increase in the number of big ships?
People will look out and watch this scene happening where they'll see a lot of boats around the whales, and they'll assume that that's the bigger problem for them than the big ship passing by out there in the middle of the strait. So people are going off of what they see visually. So there has been a lot of push from people who aren't necessarily aware of how the whales actually live in this world of sound, not the world of sight. And so there's, I think, a lot of misperception, but it's also because people are just desperate to try to find anything to save these whales. Mm-hmm. So they've been looking for scapegoats, and right now the whale watch boats are kind of the scapegoats.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the salmon, the Chinook. This is the next big challenge these guys have.
That's right. As I mentioned, 80% of their diet is Chinook. They go for the big fatty fish. And the Chinook runs have just been plunging in numbers all along the West Coast. So when we see them in the summer, they've come inside of the continental shelf and are here inside of the, what we call the Salish Sea area, the area actually north of Puget Sound and Seattle, and in between Seattle and Vancouver. And one of the things that actually happens, of course, is that there's been a tremendous loss of Chinook runs in the Puget Sound. So they've really lost a lot of fish here. The one river that remains undammed is the Fraser River in British Columbia, which comes out at Vancouver. And that's where the main run of Chinook has been coming from for the last 20 years, that has provided, you know, basically motivation for these whales to come in to our interior waters here. But now that river is mysteriously losing its salmon runs as well. A lot of it has to do with development, but there's some concern that oceanic warming is having an effect as well. So we're not really sure why the Fraser numbers have plunged. However, the larger population of Chinook along the entire West Coast, and particularly the continental shelf, is really where these whales spend most of their time, and that's most of their diet. And absolutely the number one contributor of salmon in along that shelf is the Columbia River. And as we know, the Columbia River's Chinook runs and general salmon runs, including sockeye and others, have also been plummeting. And it's not a secret that most fish biologists are pretty confident that the number one problem for those runs are those four dams on the Lower Snake River between Lewiston and Richland. Because they basically have killed all of the salmon runs that come from Idaho. When I was a kid growing up in Idaho, my family had a cabin there in Stanley area. And I remember being a kid in the early 60s, seeing the, and go down to the spawning beds there between Stanley and Alturas Lake, and the water would just boil with these salmon, with the, all the salmon that were there. It looked like you could walk across the river. There were so many salmon. And, you know, as you know, by 1993, I think we were down to one lonesome Larry coming back to Redfish Lake. And it was all because of those dams. Those dams killed off all those salmon runs. And they still want to keep those dams going, even though they only produce 3% of the Northwest energy grid. And so it's not entirely clear why the Fisheries Service, which is supposed to have called you know, basically determined whether or not the recovery was a failure or success many years ago, has refused to make that call. But that's kind of where we're at right now.
Well, even if they make that call, doesn't somebody in very high authority have to be the ones to say the dams must go? And I just can't see how that happens. I mean, I believe it ought to happen. Don't get me wrong, but
yeah. It's actually in the law. It was in the law when those dams were built, and it's been in the. It's part of why the federal judge right now, Judge Simon, is holding the BPA's feet to the fire on this, because back in 2002, when they did the environmental impact statement, it was very clear that if the salmon runs did not recover at the rate that they were supposed to, then the National Marine Fisheries Service was to declare the recovery a failure and that those dams were supposed to be removed.
Oh, I see. Well, that's pretty powerful.
Yeah. And they've just never pulled the trigger, because the BPA is a very powerful agency and they have a lot of friends in very high places. So,
well, can Governor Jay Inslee confront them, or this is a guy who's spending some time in New Hampshire trying to decide whether he wants to run for president. So I'm not so sure he's in a position politically where he's going to take a big stroke of courage here.
Yeah, I mean, Jay's done a fine job of actually, he did call the ORCA panel together and has taken it seriously, and I commend him for that. But what we're seeing so far, I mean, honestly, if we're going to save this population of whales, Bob, it's going to take some political courage.
Yeah.
And right now, nobody is showing it.
Yeah. That's really a sad story. And I must say that you ended your book on a note like that when you said something about, you know, it's a noble effort, even if perhaps doomed.
Yeah.
That sums it up well.
Yeah, I think that, honestly, I think that the fate of the orcas is a harbinger of our own fate. I really believe that if we can't sort of reverse our, you know, our historic deprivation of salmon runs, which, you know, began in Europe, went to the East Coast, and is now continuing here on the West Coast, it's the same history where we just go in and wipe everything out. And then there's no food for anybody except for what's raised in a salmon pen with hormones and steroids, you know.
Right.
I don't think that that's where we want to be. And I think eventually, you know, I think if we see killer whales go extinct, I think it's a harbinger that our own extinction is on the horizon.
Well, David, I really thank you for joining us today. First of all, for writing the book, and the book is Of Orcas and Men, What Killer Whales Can Teach Us. Our author, we've been talking to for the last half hour, is David Nywert. And we thank you so much for doing this, and we wish you the very best as you continue to advocate and report on the orca killer whale.
Thank you for having me, Bob. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, David. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.